Before I begin this class, I would like to add a little bit of an addendum onto Elton's class. After class, we were discussing, and he told me there was one little something he wanted to add, and I thought it was noteworthy enough that I'm going to add it for him, and I don't know if I'll do an adequate job or not, but those of you who were in his class remember that a few weeks ago we talked about in Ezekiel that Ezekiel was in the spirit and he was on a high mountain overlooking the city of Jerusalem in the temple area. And he saw the Shekinah, the glory of God, leaving the temple. And it came to a certain door in the temple. And then it went to out that door. It went to the east side of the city. And then this, I don't know if the proper word is not contraption, but this thing came and got the glory of God and took it away. And he saw the glory leave. And it was a really, really sad time in the history of Israel because God no longer inhabited the temple. And it marked a catastrophic time in Israel's history. And from that time on, and Elton drew a really neat parallel that I told him, and I'll certainly share with you, that I had never thought of, never had it put in those words, and it literally sent a chill up and down my spine that from that time on, God did not dwell with men in the way that he had. And on Acts chapter 2, when these people were all gathered together in this room, there came a sound. Perhaps a similar sound as to what took God's glory away when it went. But this time it's coming back. And the people saw and heard, they heard the sound and they saw what looked like little cloven tongues of fire that came and set over the head of each person there. And they began to speak in tongues. And Elton's point was that this is God's glory coming back to inhabit the new tabernacle. And 1 Corinthians chapter 6 says, that's us. Don't you know that your bodies are the temple of God? And that sound, perhaps, may have been the same thing that took him away, the same thing that came back. And one time back, several weeks ago, he mentioned the word helicopter, and he wasn't saying that it was a helicopter, but it's kind of like got a ride on this thing that Ezekiel described as these wheels that had eyes all around and so forth, and the cherubim were there and so forth, and above it was the glory of God. And if you can imagine being in, some of you, maybe all of you have been in the presence of a helicopter when it landed or when it took off, and you get that backwash and that noise, then they had this sound and this thing, this heavenly conveyance took God's glory away in Ezekiel, and then it brought it back in Acts chapter 2, and now God's spirit has taken up a new place. God no longer dwells in temples made with men's hands as though he had need of anything, Paul will say in his address on Mars Hill. And then one other point that Elton made before that temple, even in the Old Testament, the temple had to be cleansed and purified, right? And they went through great, great, great rituals to make sure that it was pure, and God cannot dwell in a place that's not pure. And so before God's Spirit could come and take up residence in this new tabernacle, us as Christians, we had to be cleansed. The tabernacle had to be cleansed. Guess when that took place? When they were baptized in Acts chapter 2. And now God imputes his righteousness to this new place. Now, if that doesn't put a little chill up and down your spine, then you're not like me. I mean, that's an incredible thought to think about, because God had a manifestation of presence in that old temple, in the old tabernacle, and then in the temple. And we've been tracing that in Elton's class, going from the construction of the tabernacle to the construction of the temple, and then God's glory dwelt in that holy of holies. And then it left. Ezekiel saw it leave, and then it came back in Acts chapter 2. And today, do you not know that your bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit, which you have in you of God? and you're not your own. You're bought with a price. And so now this new temple, we're walking around. And one day, before too long, we'll probably have another series of lessons on New Testament worship that will kind of use that and spring from that concept. So anyway, just I wanted to add that addendum to Elton's class. And do you have any other comments you want to add to that? That's right. That's right. There was no forgiveness of sin without blood, and it was Jesus' blood that was the only one that blood of bulls and goats can't get that job done. So it took Jesus' blood. With your body. That's right. That's right. Yeah, there are many, many passages that fit right in here. Tyrone said that last verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 will conclude, therefore glorify God in your body and your spirit, which are God's. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God. Okay. All right. And we could talk about that a long time. That's a really neat. And I appreciate Elton's class in tracing the tabernacle and the temple. And to be real honest with you, I'm glad that I'm on the same team with somebody who is able and enjoys what I consider to be kind of tedious things and putting them together and showing the significance that they have. And so I really did enjoy and appreciate Elton's class. Now we're shifting gears. We're going to the New Testament. We're coming to the book of Romans, and I have a few comments that I want to make, and so I just got to get those out of my system, okay? And so that's kind of what today's lesson is going to be. I have been looking forward to this class with some reservations. Since I first began preaching and teaching, most of you have heard at least enough of my, quote, story to know that I grew up not knowing what I wanted to be, but I knew what I was not going to be. My dad was a preacher, and I saw what I considered to be some pretty rough sides of preaching and the way that people have treated preachers. And my dad never took any money for preaching, and I felt like that when somebody went to the trouble and as much as of his life as he put into that, that there should have been some appreciation shown, and I saw very little in my life. And so I grew up with some anger, to be real honest with you, about preachers and preachers' kids and the whole scenario. And so I didn't know what I was going to be, but I knew that I was not going to be a preacher. And then as I got a little older, my thought was, well, you know, sometime I might fill in for a place if they don't have a preacher or whatever, but I'm not going to, quote, and this is my own stigma, I'm not going to depend on the brethren for my livelihood. And that made the decision to be a preacher a really difficult decision for me. And it wouldn't have happened for good or bad. Whether it would have been better or not, I'll leave for you and the Lord to judge. But that would not have happened. I wouldn't be preaching today if it were not for the book of Romans. The book of Romans changed my life. And I say that without any reservations. I fought it. I was introduced to it in the School of Preaching at White's Ferry Road, was in the first class. Tyrone also graduated from there. And It was a hard, hard struggle for me. I went to school not to be a preacher. I went with a fierce determination for at least a year. Everybody that would listen to me, I would tell them, hey, you need to know I'm not going to be a preacher. I'm just coming here to get my own life straightened out. And that was the truth. That's why I went, because I had some things in my life that I needed. I knew that I needed to change. I wanted to change, but I wasn't doing a very good job in getting them changed. And so I saw that as a vehicle to help me for if I would just put my life on hold for 2 years, then I could study the Bible and get my life straightened out, and then I'd go back to my life as it was laid out before then. And my plan almost worked until into the second year I came across the book of Romans. And whenever the things that were taught really bothered me. because of my background. I grew up very conservatively. I'm not ashamed of that, because I think maybe growing up conservatively, you can more easily make a transition into what I believe to be the truth than if you grow up on the opposite extreme. That's just my personal opinion, but I think that may be true. For one thing, you have a very, very deep appreciation for God's grace, because that was really my problem. Because I saw God's grace as something, as I really sat down and tried to evaluate God's grace and what I had heard about God's grace growing up, then I knew for certain that it had to be God's grace that got the gospel taught to me. Okay? I couldn't make any claim whatsoever for having been born in the United States of America where the gospel could be taught and preached without reservation. I could have been born in Russia. And, you know, somebody that's been born in the 90s and since that time doesn't really appreciate even what that means. Because there have been places, and there still are places in our world today. There are fewer places, but there are still places where the gospel cannot be preached and people can't own a Bible at the peril of their life, they do. But there was a large segment of the population of the world that was true about at that time. And so, as I was aware of that, I knew, I mean, I wasn't so stupid that I could make a claim that I was really smart to be born in the United States of America, okay, because I didn't have anything to do with that. God chose that. And to be born into a family that were Bible-believing and loved the Lord and tried to serve the Lord, I couldn't make any claim for that. So I knew that I could accept God's grace to that point. But once the gospel was preached to me, I really didn't see where grace really fit in any further in my life. Because now it's up to me, and I've got to do it, and I've got to accept it, and I've got to learn it, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do this. And that's the way that I viewed my life. And then whenever someone began to present to me in a class, and I had a couple of good friends that we fed off of each other, and so we would go home at night, and I'd go home just exactly as I said in my lesson this morning. Those of you that have already been preached to this morning here, you know that I talked about the older brother got angry. Well, that was my reaction to teaching of the book of Romans. I got angry, and I really got angry. And there was just something, I got angry enough that I wanted to quit school. But there was just something in it that I had to prove that this guy that was teaching it was wrong. Maybe it's something in me. And so I would go home from class and with myself and a friend or two, and we would sit down and study for hours. And we would prepare our argument for the next day in class to prove that what had been taught was wrong. And I for the first time in my life, was giving this my heart and soul, because I was really, really angry that in the Church of Christ that somebody would be teaching something like this. I'm just bearing my soul and telling you. And so I would come back the next day, and this person who was teaching was kind enough and knowledgeable enough that they didn't, as I was trying to do to him, back him against the wall and nail his hide as hard as I could, he didn't treat me that same way. And he was very kind and very gentle and would be, you know, handle me with kid gloves. And even that made me mad, you know, because I wanted to fight. And he didn't want to fight. And he wouldn't fight. And he would just say, well, Ken, would you read this passage for me? Well, I knew what the passage said. I didn't want to read the passage, you know, but he would have me read it out loud. And he said, now, would you tell us what that means? And so I would try to give it my explanation of what it meant, you know, and then in my mind, I'm thinking the five more verses that prove that this wasn't true. And so I can remember the day when I let myself entertain the remote possibility that what was being taught was true. And I cried. Because of everything that that meant. I had been telling people all my life, you've got to put what you believe to the test of the Scriptures. And if it doesn't hold to the test of the Scriptures, then you need to change it. I've been telling people that all my life. But now it's my turn, and I didn't like it. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever done because it meant a number of things. It meant admitting, number one, I was wrong, and that was hard for a 21-year-old smart-aleck kid. But it meant even more than that. It meant that now I was going to be, at least to some degree, in opposition to the people that I grew up with and the people that I loved and the people in my family. Because I knew that if I admitted and began to teach that this was true, that this was going to create some problems. And it has. I have learned, hopefully, a little in the last 35 plus years, to be able to say things in a way that's better than I first started saying them. Because I insisted, everything, all of your stubbornness doesn't just go out. And it still hasn't. But everybody had to say things my way. Because I said it the right way. You understand what I'm saying? And if anybody said it any different, I'd tolerate you saying it, but I had to straighten you out. I had to correct you. And so some difficulties came into my life as a result of that. One of them being that the first place that I preached, and I went to a congregation in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, because I'd never been in a church that had elders in my life. I grew up, and my dad started churches in towns that there was no church. And when the church would get to be about 100 people, then we would go to the next town where there was no church and start another church. And so I never got to be in a church with elders, and I wanted to work in a church that had elders, and I wanted to learn how to work with elders. And so I was in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and I was so excited about what I had learned about Romans, and that's why it made such a difference in my life, and it gave me so much relief in my life. Of pressure that I didn't know that I had. It was part of my life. The reason I'm preaching is because I want other people to feel that same thing. And I want you to understand the beauty of the gospel and what the gospel really is. And it's not just that you can do better. And so I got to the first place, and the first opportunity that I had to teach was a ladies' Bible class of all places. And if you had never had a bunch of church Christ ladies mad at you, you ain't never lived. They can eat you alive. And so I made them all mad. And they went to the elders, and they said, this guy is not teaching the truth. And so they did what they were supposed to do. They came to me and sat down. And it's a lot more complicated than this. I'm trying to shorten it up for you. But they came to me and sat down and said, Ken, you're going to have to stop teaching this. And my heart fell out. And I cried again. And I said, guys, I can't stop teaching this. And they said, well, you've got to. And I said, I can't. And I said, I understand what your responsibility is. You've got to protect the church, and if you believe that error is being taught, you've got to do something about it. I understand that. And so you do what you got to do. And what that meant in my mind was, before I ever get started, I'm fixing to get fired. And that's going to follow me for the rest of my life, and I'm going to be messed up before I ever get started out. But they didn't want to fire me, and I didn't want to get fired. And so we mulled this thing over, and finally I said, well, I have a proposal for you. Because we're at an impasse here. My proposal is, I cannot stop teaching this, but I will punch the hold button. If you men will agree to meet with me and study this topic 3 nights a week. And graciously, and fortunately, they agreed. And so for the next several months, not weeks, the next several months, we met together. And they called in people they thought could straighten me out. And we traveled around different places and went and spent the night at different places where someone, a preacher that they had respect for, that they felt like could straighten this young kid out, went there and spent the night and spent time with different preachers and so forth. None of these people were able to get me straight. And I don't say that from a prideful thing, but interestingly, I will say that one of those people particularly, and I won't ever mention his name, but he was where I had grown up. And sometime later, he wrote me a letter and apologized for the role that he had played in that, because he had come to understand more in line with what I was trying to say the Bible was teaching, and he had been put in a position and in fact did feel like that wasn't true. So after a period of time in our studying, I wish I could say that we came to complete understanding and agreement with one another. We never did. But we got to a point where they weren't afraid of me. And I got to a point where the thing that I gained the most out of that was, first of all, a respect for elders. And the second thing was a realization that everybody didn't have to say everything the way that I thought they had to say it. That somebody could say something and I need to shut my mouth and listen and see if maybe they were saying some of those things, same things in a different way. And so we both gained, and I ended up staying there for 8.5 years, and it was my choice whenever that time came to an end. And I had some great friends there. But it was a hard thing, and if you didn't grow up with a conservative bent, then I don't know that this can mean as much to you. Maybe it can, but I've never been in your shoes, and so you'll have to tell me that. I've also always taught this in a setting in my home, and because there were a large number of people who wanted to be in the class here, and I couldn't keep up with the demand in my home with about 12 people at a time, then we're doing this. I have to tell you, this is not my favorite way of doing it. That's not your fault. And it's a good thing that we're here and that we're studying it this way. I would prefer to have you 12 at a time in a circle sitting around a fire in my home studying this. Because in a larger crowd like we have here, people tend to not ask questions. And they tend to get to a point that there's something that you don't understand, you don't ask that question. And if you don't ask that question, then you're hung up right there for the rest of the class, and you don't learn anymore because your mind is still trying to go back and say, well, what did he mean there, and what does this mean, and so forth. And so I'm going to encourage you to ask questions. Now, you're going to have to speak loudly because I'm getting to a point in my life where I can't hear from the back, so you're going to have to speak loudly. We might have to get a microphone, I don't know, but we're going to record this, and so it wouldn't be a bad thing if we did that anyway. But I hope we're going to enjoy this class. I hope you're not disappointed. A number of you have said that you've really been looking forward to this for a long time, so I hope that you won't be disappointed in it. I don't think you will be. I want to tell you a little bit about what you can expect from this class. And we all come to this with certain baggage, whether we recognize it or not. And so it means different things to different people. It hits different people different ways. But if you are not certain about whether or not if you died right now you're going to heaven, if you will apply the things that we're going to study, then you can have that certainty. I know we've said it, and it started in my lifetime that preachers would start out a sermon. If somebody asks you the question, if you were to die right now, would you go to heaven? And most of us say, well, I hope so. And then the preacher would proceed to beat you over the head that that's not the right answer. You're supposed to say, yes, I know I would go. And so when somebody, we've done that long enough now so that when somebody asks you that, you don't say, I hope so anymore. You know, we've gained that much ground. And I don't know if that's good or not if you don't really believe that, if you don't know that, if you don't know why saying that is not arrogance at all. Because as I grew up, from my perspective, if somebody said, yes, if I were to die right now, I know I would go to heaven, my thought about that person was, this has to be the most arrogant person I've ever met. Because you can't know that. And so, that's one of the things that you can gain, and I hope you will gain from this. You're going to have to put something in it, too. It's not just enough to hear it. And sometimes you have to hear it more than one time. If you're like me, I have to hear something three times. It's taken me a while to know that, but I know that about myself. If there's something that I don't understand and I don't know the first time, it goes about 98% over my head. But I catch a little something, enough to pique my curiosity to make me start asking questions. And the second time, I start getting the facts together to make what I consider an informed decision about this. And the third time that somebody presents it to me, it starts sinking in. Now, that's because I have a thick skull, and hopefully yours is not that thick. Hopefully you can catch it quicker than that. But don't be surprised if some of these things you have to hear more than one time. And I'll repeat some of these things over. Some of them I think is essential enough that I'll repeat them many times in the class. Things have changed from when I first started teaching and preaching the book of Romans. If I were to ask, when I first started preaching, if I were to be in a class, particularly where people felt free to respond to it, and I were to say, ask the question, why is a person lost? Then the majority of the answers would have come back something like, because a person is lost because they haven't obeyed the gospel. Or they're lost because they haven't been baptized. That would have been the answer. That's not the answer that you most frequently get now, but that would have been by far the most frequent answer that I would have gotten initially. Our society has changed a lot since I was a kid. For years, every single time I would teach this in my home, the first part, as you see on your outline, is talking about condemnation, how and why we're lost. Then that was not a difficult section to teach because people felt like they were lost. And people pretty readily accepted that they were lost. That's changed. Today, people don't feel like they're lost. I'm okay, you're okay. And you start trying to tell somebody that they're a sinner, then they get insulted. Because I'm a good guy. And you're trying to tell me that God's going to send me to hell. And all of these people out here that are my friends in the world, there's some really good people out here, and you're telling me that they're going to go to hell? I had somebody tell me this past week, well, if heaven is going to be people like Glenn Beck, I don't want to go there anyway. I'm saying we live in a different time, and people's attitude is different. We would get to the second part that talked about how God has made us righteous to the gospel. And without fail, and it happened dozens and dozens of times, I would look up and everybody in the class is crying. Because it was too good to be true. And that's changed. Because we feel like that we're pretty good people today. And so the second part, when we start talking about God's grace, we think, yeah, why, of course, I'm a good person. And so things have changed. To be real honest with you, and don't take this wrong, because I'm not pointing the finger at any one person. I liked it better the first way. I liked it better when the good news really was wonderfully good news. And it broke people's heart to know that God loved them enough that He made it possible for them, for us to be righteous. I like that. And it's not much fun trying to persuade people that they're sinners if they don't believe they're sinners. And so most people have quit trying, and you don't hear much about sin anymore. And we just get deeper and deeper in the rut that we're getting ourselves into in this society. Because we just feel good about ourselves, and churches that are really large mega churches, that's what they center on, is making us feel good about ourselves regardless of who we are or what we do. And so we're where we are, and you judge where that may be. But one of the things that we'll look at, and I've put together a PowerPoint. I'm not a PowerPoint guy, as you know, and I started not to even put it up, you know, but I'm going to use it a little bit. I'm not going to depend on it, but I'm going to use it a little bit. There are some things, some of the things that we'll address in this study of Romans chapters 1 through 8 is how and why a person is lost. And in this study, I'm going to say to you that we're going to scrape it all the way down to the rind. We're going to ask the bottom line questions. And it's not just have the lip off the tongue answers, the traditional answers. We're going to really look at why, how it is, how it's come about that I'm in the shape that I am, that I am a sinner, and that I've separated myself from God. And how did that happen? And we're going to ask and answer the question, how is God going to judge a person who's never had a chance to hear the gospel before? Now, has that ever bothered you? Well, if it hasn't, then you're different from me, because it bothered me as a kid. It bothered me. And it used to really give me some problems, and it's one of the things that gives people problems why they reject the whole concept of religion and the gospel altogether. Because they say, well, you're telling me that God's going to send everybody, all these people out here who never had a chance to gospel, hear the gospel. You're telling me that God's going to send all these people to hell? Now, has that never bothered you in your life? Or we're going to address that. And we're going to address it from the scriptures here. What standard is God going to use, and what's going to be the result of people who lived and died? Do you think that there are people who are dying today that never had a chance to hear the gospel? The answer is yes, there are. How's God going to judge that person when he stands before him? Another thing we're going to look at is, what does God offer me? And you know, we don't ask that question just in that way as much here in America, even though maybe it's being asked more than it used to be. But when you go somewhere like former USSR countries, CIS countries now, Consortium of Independent States, you go to those countries, and one of the things that those people ask you straight out is they'll say, I mean, they've been taught that there is no God, and for you to try to get them to entertain the thought that there is a God, and you know, that there's a heaven and a hell and so forth, then one of the questions that they'll look you right in the eye and say, well, why are you a Christian? What does it do for you? What's God got to offer me? And you know what? That's a legitimate question. It really is. And I'll tell you another thing. It's a question that lots of Christians are not prepared to handle. We'll argue with you about why you should be baptized, and we'll argue with you about whether or not you should use an instrument in the assembly, and we'll argue with you about lots of things. And we got all those verses down and written in our Bible if we forget them, and we got all those arguments down. But when somebody comes up and says, tell me why I should be a Christian, you say, well, so you can go to heaven. Well, that's not exactly, they don't know much about that at this point. They're saying, what advantage is there to me to be a Christian? You know, I look at what I see of being a Christian doesn't look just real appealing. And so why should I be a Christian? What's it going to do for my life? So we're going to talk about that. What does God offer me? And then how do I get what he offers? Does he just blanket give it to everybody who says, raises their hand and said, you know, I believe? Or how do I obtain the things that God offers to me? And then as people begin to entertain the thought of maybe becoming a Christian, then they say, well, I can't live it. And we're going to talk about that when we get to Romans chapter 5 and after that, about how God enables us to accomplish what he wants us to accomplish in our life. Okay, outline. And now I'm on part of the little paper. Did everybody get one of the handouts? If you didn't get a handout, have we got an extra one or two somewhere? Here, take this one right here. Okay. Anybody else need one? Okay, right over here. Thanks. Outline of Romans chapter 1 through 8. And this is one of those, when you look at it, you know, if you're a Bible student and you like really detailed outlines, I'm an outline person. Okay, I really am. I really believe if you can't outline it, you don't know it. I mean, if you can, you have to be able to outline it in order to teach it. You got to be able to, as Elton says, you got to be able to put a model of it up there. Well, my thing is, when you read a section of scripture, you need to be able to outline it. And if you understand it, you can outline it. Now, I'm not saying it all falls under 3 points every time or whatever, but you can outline it. And you get a little bit skeptical over the years as you look at outlines, because some of them really, really hit the nail on the head, and others have an agenda, okay, and they're trying to prove something, and it's not really what the scripture was saying. And this little outline may look like it is, but I'm telling you, I think it hits the nail on the head. Just because it's simple and one word at a time, don't let that fool you. Chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 20 is talking about condemnation. This is how and why we're lost. And we're going to spend a lot of time on that, and we're going to talk a lot about law. And to be honest with you, a number of the lessons that I have been teaching and preaching from the pulpit have been leading us up to this right here, because we've spent some time talking about the true gospel, and we've spent lots of time, a considerable amount of time, talking about law and the purpose of law. We're going to go back over that and put it in this context here. And so I've been kind of priming you a little bit for this study anyway for the last several months, because it's really kind of a shock, and there's going to be some things that sometimes we study something and we get right up to the cusp of the matter. We get right to the edge, and then we back off because we don't want to draw the conclusion. Well, we're going to draw the conclusion. And, you know, you can know a lot of things to be true, and in your heart of hearts, you can know that something is true, but if you never say it, it's like it's not true. It's not real. Well, you're going to say it in here, okay? We're going to say it, because until you say it, you can't move any further. It's not real to you. You got to say it. You've got to admit it to yourself. And so we're going to be looking at how and why a person that's going to is lost, and what our problem is, and why we need the Lord. There's a lot that depends on you coming to the realization of your true situation. Everything depends. It starts here. You can't repent. You can't truly repent until you know that you need to. And so I'm going to have to persuade you of how badly you need the Lord. Or if you want to just say it the way that I really feel it, how bad you are. Because most of us think we're pretty good, but we're not pretty good. And by the way, it'll probably occur to you, but I'll go ahead and tip my hand a little bit. This older brother, younger brother parable here, this is just another way of looking at the book of Romans. It really is just another way to see you're lost and I'm lost. You're not okay and I'm not okay. And if the Lord doesn't come along and do it for us, none of us are going to be okay. And the ground at the foot of the cross is level, whether you're a younger son or an older son. And that's why we're really hammering on this older son business right now, because we don't feel lost. We feel okay. And if you don't believe me, just look around, look at my life, and, you know, I'm a pretty good person. I don't do this, and 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 I'm pretty honest, and I'm this, and I'm this, and look at all these wicked people out there, you know. And so, 1:18 to 3:20, you've got an assignment for next week. I want you to read Romans, the first three chapters, down to verse 20. And I'll tell you why. We'll stop right there in just a moment. I want you to read that five times this week. It doesn't take you but just a few minutes to read it. So I want you to read that five times. Now, I'm really encouraging you to do this because I'm telling you that this study can make a difference in your life. It can change your life if you'll let it. But you're going to have to put something into it for that to happen to you. If it's just an exercise and somebody's standing up and teaching you something, then I'm not saying it's of no value, but you're not getting one-tenth of the good out of it. There's a lot more in it for you if you'll put something into it. So your assignment is to read, start at 1:1, okay, and read down to chapter 3, verse 20. And if you, I know you want to read to the end of the chapter. It's fine for you to do that too, but I want you to at least read down to 3:20 five times this week in preparation for our class. And then after we've learned what our true situation is and that we're not righteous, then chapter 3, verse 21 through chapter 5, verse 21 tells us how we are made righteous. Justification. Justification. And so if you got your Bibles open, just a little quick little note here. Look at chapter 3, verse 21. 3:21 starts out with what? What does it say? What's the first word say? But now. But now. Whenever you read the word but, what does that mean is about to happen? You're fixing to show a contrast, right? Fixing to show a contrast. And so everything he said from 1:18 to 3:20 is true, and now that he's established that, and this is the way it is, here's where we are. But now, let me show you something different. And the change that is made from 1:18 or from chapter 3, verse 20 to chapter 21 is, it's worlds apart. It's totally so radically different from one another. Because in 1:18 to 3:20, we're going to be seeing about how man tries to save himself and how he tries to be good enough to go to heaven. And it's all going to be around focusing around me and where my righteousness comes from. And do you realize the whole world turns on that one thing? That you really, really understand where your righteousness comes from. If you don't understand that, you can't understand the, you don't know what the gospel is if you don't understand that. And how you get saved and how you stay saved. You need to understand that. There's nothing more important in the whole world. And so from 3:21 to 5:21, we're going to talk about how you get saved. How God makes you righteous. And then the next one is chapter 6 and 7. Sanctification is just a word that means how you stay saved. Justification is how you get saved. Sanctification is how you stay saved. Chapter 6 and 7. Because if it's true, and see, as you progress in your understanding, you get to the point that you understand, okay, it's by God's grace that I got saved. He forgave my past sins. I don't deserve that. He did that, right? But now, and my but now, would have said, okay, you got to do it now. Okay, he got you saved. Now you got to keep yourself saved. And you got to come to church, and you got to take the Lord's Supper, and you got to give your money, and you got to tell people about Jesus. You got to do this, and 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 you can't lie, and you can't cheat, and you can't steal, and you can't commit adultery, and you can't do this, and you can't. And so we depend on law to keep us saved. And don't tell me that there are not some people in here that believe that. I know there are. You can't keep yourself saved any more than you could get yourself saved. And the interesting thing is, that's good news. You think it's not. When you first start out, it might even make you mad. It made me mad. the very idea that I couldn't keep myself saved. Do you think I'm that weak that I can't keep myself saved? Of course I can. Now, I might have to repent of my sins every now and then and get back level with the board, you know, and walk the aisle and confess my sins and get back even again if I get myself in too bad a shape. Don't tell me that we don't think that way. And part of the sad thing is we quit walking the aisle. When I first started preaching, there'd be over 300 people a year that would walk the aisle. I'm not preaching anything different now than I was then. And that wasn't a bad thing, necessarily. It wasn't a good thing, necessarily. It depends on what your motivation was. But unfortunately, some of our motivation was what we condemn certain religious groups for going to the priest and confessing their sins. And then they get the board all cleared off. Well, we did that with prayer. And I know we did because we would say things, and I heard it 1,000 times, maybe 10,000 times growing up. Lord, forgive us since we last stood justified in your sight. I heard it over and over and over. What does that mean? Forgive us of the many sins that we've committed since we last stood justified in your sight. And we would start out our church service, and the guy that led the first prayer would say, Lord, forgive us of the many sins that we have committed since we last stood justified in your sight. And so we all got cleared. And then the last prayer, guess what he would say? Lord, forgive us since we last stood justified in your sight. And I'm thinking, boy, what have these people been doing in here while they're in church, you know? And, you know, and I think it's okay that we laugh about it a little bit, but it's really serious too. Because while we would never have admitted that, this was our confessional. And we were going up there and getting forgiven from prayer to prayer. And if I got run over by a train and I got blindsided and I didn't say, Lord, forgive me for my many sins just before I got taken out, I might not make it. You got a better chance at that at the roulette wheel. Don't you? I mean, I'd like my odds of throwing dice better than that. And if that's true, then whenever I came up out of the baptism, somebody needed to shot me right square between the eyes because I would be saved. Then I'd go to heaven. That's the last time that I knew that I'd go to heaven. And, I mean, we're just out here in peril ever since that time and having no confidence. Because, for sure, it wasn't too long after I was baptized that I had a bad thought. And so here I was, back in the same shape again. Man, is that what God sent His Son to die, to give us that level of hope? Surely it's something more than that, huh? And because there are people who teach error about that doesn't mean that I can't believe the truth. And just because somebody else that teaches error walks in the front door doesn't mean I have to crawl through the window. And then our next one, and are there bells? They're supposed to be. We'll get that straightened out. Next one, and we'll go real quickly, is glorification. And that's what's going to ultimately happen to us, what God's going to do for us. Then we're not going to get this far. In fact, the last time I taught this in the young couples class, we went for 6 months, and I didn't even get through chapter 8. I didn't get to chapter 8, so I'll try to do better this time. Chapters 9 through 11 is vindication, and that simply is that the Jews will say, God gave us as a nation all these promises. And if the Gentiles get this, if the Gentiles get this blessing, then God hasn't been true to His promises to us. God owes us as a nation certain things that He promised to give us, and He hasn't come through with that. And so chapters 9 through 11 is going to vindicate God. It's going to go back and show those promises and show that those promises, number one, were conditional, and number two, He originally told Abraham that you're going to be the father of many nations. Many nations. And God's going to bless all nations through your seed. So anyway, he's going to clear that up. And then chapters 12 through 16 is an application of what we've learned. Most of Paul's letters are that way. You'll have the first half of it essentially is doctrinal, and the last half is practical application. So we'll look at that. Okay, anybody have anything that's burning on your heart to say that you want to say? Any question? Okay, read 1:18 to 3:20 five times between now and next Sunday. Thank you.